Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
London society is full of women of the very highest birth who have, of their own free choice, remained 35 for years. Oscar Wilde.
So as usual, I've opened the front door and grabbed the first two likely-looking Londoners who happen to be out there.
It does seem that everyone's got a story to tell.
I think screaming does help as well.
Ooh, yes, the Horniman walrus.
They dug out bodies in 1887, 1873.
What did he look like when he came out the other end of that?
Knackered.
Got Sarah Palin coming. How do you feel about that?
A little bit pathetic.
So we're in the parlour of Dr. Johnson's house.
One sees a story that is both of protests and of coming together.
So they're banning people from bringing food to homeless.
Yeah, they're banning soup runs.
You know, we weren't buckled by the tailors.
A word in your eye, don't worry or push. A step in the gate is worth two in the bush.
Which area of ridiculousness do we start on with that story? Why would you give a medal to a pigeon?
Listen, you're all idiots. You know, it's my culture or anything.
No running, no throwing. This is pretty serious stuff.
You engage with other people, you link across to other people.
It's just huge. It's gigantic.
How many times have you done this so far?
That depends.
What do you think of that approach?
I think that's terrible.
London life is a really rich experience, and there's a lot that's good about living
Boris
here.
Boris Johnson.
He weighs as much as 40 school children.
What a peculiar conversation. Hello, it's Friday, October the 12th, 2012. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud, a podcast of news, views, and curiosities from London, UK. You can download the show free on iTunes, hook up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, or tweet me at Londonist Sound. Well, the Foundling Museum was established in 1998 as a charity to care for the Foundling Hospital collection. Following an extensive fundraising, renovation and rebuilding campaign, the Foundling Museum opened in 2004. They've got a fantastic exhibition here all about Charles Dickens and his responsibilities and contributions to the museum. Between 1837 and 39, Dickens lived right next to the Foundling Hospital estate in 48 Doughty Street, now the Charles Dickens Museum, and he supported the hospital both financially and through his writing. Director Cara Howell will be giving us a guided tour of the exhibition shortly. Well, here with me today, I've got Chris West, who gives serious and humorous talks about the life and times of Charles Dickens, his London, his bridges, his law, his buildings and his Docklands. And I think we may be talking today about his women, too. Well, the big Victorian question, of course, or the big question springing from the Victorian era, I should say, how do you write a fresh book about Jack the Ripper? Crime journalist Peter Stubley, who is here with us now, too, hit on the idea of examining the other London murders of 1888. And there's about 50 or so in total?
Yeah, I mean, about murders themselves is about 30-ish, but if you include other manslaughter-type things and infanticides, then you... heading up towards almost 100.
Let me get a handle on this. Is this project of writing about all the other murders that happened in 88, is it a move against the sort of sensationalist ripperism that we've been talking about actually in previous episodes?
Well, it's an attempt to look at it from a different angle, and the idea was to sort of illustrate how what life was like in London in 1888 by looking at, you know, the vast array of other murders and killings and deaths that are happening around that time, just to give you a better idea rather than just talk about, you know, women who were brutally murdered in the streets of East London.
Because it still seems as though you're going for the most sensationalist element, really, if we're being honest about it.
Well, there are plenty of interesting stories, that's true, but the thing about murder cases is that because they were covered quite well in newspapers at the time, and because the trials were you know, were covered in the proceedings of the Old Bailey. There's quite a lot of information there about family life and the circumstances of what drove people to kill their children or their lovers. And so it sort of gives you a really good portrait of sort of life at that time.
So my understanding, Chris West, is that your periods just slightly miss each other in terms of the lifespan of Charles Dickens and 1888. That's, of course, Peter's specialist area.
Yes, indeed. Dickens died, didn't he, in 1870. But I think he was acknowledged as the first crime novelist.
Oh, in a particular novel?
Well, several, the sort of whodunit aspect of things come into a number of his novels, and he was always very interested in the London police and particularly the murkier side of murder and wanting to avoid public hangings and all sorts.
We know him as quite the campaigner, particularly for social reform. He's a philanthropist, as we're going to discover in today's show. One thing that I realise when we talk about Dickens is that everybody knows who he is, but not everybody, in fact, far from everybody, has read much or indeed any of his output. We might be sort of familiar through TV renderings of things like Oliver Twist or Bleak House or something like that. Very few people. I know Peter can afford to be smug here because he's just embarked on a full reading of Dickens.
My knowledge is mainly based on Lady Bird books from childhood and abridged versions, so I'm actually trying to read the proper full works.
So let's have a literary... can you do us, Chris, a literary potted history of Dickens? How did his writing develop?
He started with papers, as you say. He was becoming an established writer by the age of 23, 24. He did lots of letters as Boz. That was his code name, as it were, for his early writing.
Where were these letters appearing?
They would appear all over London, but they also went all over the country, and people would queue up at the railway station or whatever to pick up the latest newsletters from him. And then the early novels, they were done in serial form. So again, they came out fortnightly or monthly and again were distributed around the country. And then his novels developed. By 27, 28, he was sort of Michael Jackson of his time. When he went to America, he was mobbed with hysteria, and he had a great tour of America, and he went back a second time later in his life. Then his later novels got rather deeper, and if you think of we're just thinking in terms of murders and whodunits, think of Mystery of Edwin Drood, which was his last novel, and he was only halfway through it when he died.
Tell me about Queen Victoria's near involvement in that story.
I don't mean it disrespectfully, but, you know, silly lady. He did actually go to see her in, I think it was February or March in the year that he died, and it was a very long in her presence. She stood. He wasn't allowed to sit before the monarch, although he was riddled with gout and heaven knows what else, including piles. So she did stand for him. And during the conversation, he did say to her, my latest novel, Edwin Drood, would you like to be sent copies of the whole synopsis? And unfortunately, she said no. If she'd said yes, we would have avoided possibly the greatest mystery of all time. It's well known that there's been more discussion about about what would have been the ending than all the rest of his novels put together. On the other hand, of course, it's part of the mystery of Dickens that we still have the mystery of Edwin Drood.
Well, another great mystery, overexploited to my mind, is that of Jack the Ripper, and lots of ideas as to who he may have been. What interest me is whether the police resources that were deployed to try and deal with that issue matched the furore about who he may have been and the sensational murders. In looking at the other murders that happened in 1888, Peter, did you note that police were being taken away from those cases in order to deal with this high-profile one?
It's hard to tell, but I mean, I think at the height of it, they virtually swamped the entire East End with police officers, some undercover, hiding in corners, waiting to, in case the killer came along with trying to look for a woman to kill.
This was preventative then, rather than to aid detection.
I mean, I think that was the only thing they could do, because they didn't really have any clue who it was. I mean, and I think one of the legends of Jack the Ripper is that, despite, I think on September, the night of September the 30th, early hours of September 30th, they even though they'd swamped the whole area with police officers, he still managed to sneak in between them and supposedly carried out two murders that night. So he's either, you know, a fiend. This is where the legend of his fiendish genius comes from. But
it could be fiendish stupidity on the part of the police at the time.
It could be. They were certainly got a lot of stick in the newspapers at the time. I mean, I think at one point the commissioner they decided to test some bloodhounds out in Hyde Park, and the commissioner of police, Charles Warren, decided to act as the bait. So he's almost the killer running away, and they sort of set the dogs off trying to catch him. And so he was roundly mocked for this in the newspapers at the time, and basically they were calling for his resignation, and in fact he did resign just before the last supposed murder. Although theoretically it was over a different matter. But
I seem to remember there was a chap, was it maybe in Manchester, a senior police officer who allowed himself to be shot with a taser to prove their effectiveness. That sounds vaguely comparable. I've managed to lure you directly into the first murder you've talked about has been, in fact, Jack the Ripper, when that's precisely not what the book is about. Tell us about some of the other appalling... Sorry, it sounds so cavalier. Tell us about some of the other gruesome stuff going on.
It ties in quite well with the Foundling Museum, because they were talking about fallen women, and fallen women is quite a theme in that era, because you've got at that time when there's no abortion, or abortion is illegal, then there's quite a lot of cases of babies who are, you know, newborn babies, illegitimate children who are sort of left in the street or hidden in cellars, or in one case it's put in a kitchen grate and burnt. Or in various other cases, chopped up. I mean, this is a bit gruesome, but these are the kind of things that happen because the mothers were so desperate to sort of avoid the stigma of being with child. And a lot of them were servants, and so they feared losing their job or their reputation. So it seemed that they were so desperate that they turned to, you know, getting rid of the child, although you could argue that some of them may have been stillborn or died soon after birth. I mean, it was difficult to tell the difference, so that a lot of the time, even though some of them were charged, some of the mothers were charged with murder, the authorities sort of took pity on them quite a lot, juries and judges, and so they occasionally got convicted of concealing the birth rather than, you know, actually killing the child. So
yes, which of course one must remember could be rewarded with capital punishment in that day. So we're saying that, what, a large proportion of these murders were infanticide?
I think in some statistics it said that half of the homicides were, you know, young children, maybe under 12 months. But it's very hard to sort of get, you know, full statistics, because some of them were never, they never traced the mother, and they don't know how they died anyway. So it's a bit of a grey area to sort of look into. But there's plenty of reports in papers of babies being found in various places.
Well, crikey, you can see why social reform was necessary. And it's interesting as well, isn't it? Because perhaps the Jack the Ripper mystery might be solved if the same sort of DNA evidence or CCTV, some of those things that kind of join the dots, not necessarily identifying what killed the person, but tying things together a little bit. I'm conscious that there's definitely a link between the institution we're in today, the Foundling Museum, and Great Ormond Street Hospital, which is just around the corner. And I know, Chris, that Dickens is being featured there as well by yourself. There's a big project you're working up at the moment.
Yes, there is indeed. The 200 years of Charles Dickens we're all celebrating. And also I have a personal involvement to do with my grandchild and Great Ormond Street Hospital. And so I'm organising a very big event called Dickens Day for Great Ormond Street Hospital on Sunday the 25th of November at the very salubrious premises of the Royal Society for Medicine.
Yes, I thought you were kidding when you suggested how luxurious it was, but why is it so well appointed?
Well, they certainly look after themselves. The theatre is the most splendid thing. I mean, the youngsters are going to sit there in these gorgeous plush seats, and they've got interaction with computers and heaven as well. And the actual electronics and lighting looks to me better than any London theatre. So it's a great privilege to be there.
And what's going to be going on the day?
schools and choirs will be coming through and doing performances of period music or drama for maybe 10 minutes or up to 40 minutes. So they will be in the theatre doing that. And then there will also be a luxury lecture theatre, which will be bashing out inspirational talks every half an hour. And we will have people like Olympic, Paralympic medalists and people who've done extremely well themselves and who are good at talking to children inspirationally, so that the children will really have a great time. There will also be a Christmas fair to do Christmas shopping and an exhibition area. So it's quite a big event.
And did Dickens have a direct relationship with Great Ormond Street?
Very much so, very much so. He was probably their second greatest benefactor. They had, I think it was 10 beds, and they were struggling. And he did one of his one-man talks, I think featuring Christmas Carol. And he raised a lot of money, and then through his writing, etc. And I might mention, I did actually do a BBC film. It lasts about 10 minutes about his relationship with Great Ormond Street Hospital. It shows where he was writing to the politicians, the church people, government, etc., saying we need to have more beds because we've got children dying in the streets in London. It's appalling.
I don't want to take you onto territory that you would be uncomfortable with, but I think that it could only be beneficial to understand the sort of work that Great Ormond Street does to furnish our listener with an example. And I know that, you, as you mentioned, you've got one from your personal family history.
Yes. Yes, my granddaughter, Natasha, she was 7 weeks old, bless her, and about 6 inches long, I think. And she had a cyst in her throat. And so she was admitted as quickly as possible to Great Ormond Street Hospital. They were brilliant. They didn't want to operate till they were ready because they said, she's so young, we want to learn more and more about her. And then she had to go into intensive care. So we had all that, observing their absolute excellence. And then in the middle of the night, they decided to operate because the cyst had grown further. And it was highly successful. It's not malignant. She's now 14 months old and you can hardly see the scar, but she would have died that night.
What's her name? Can we say hello to her?
Hello, Natasha, yes.
Hello, Natasha. Well, good to have you still with us. That's just one example of the great work that Great Ormond Street does. Who was their biggest benefactor?
Actually, the writer of Peter Pan. All the royalties went to Great Ormond Street Hospital from that book.
J.M. Barrie, of course, yeah. I had a nasty feeling that another famous figure hung over it, but I might be thinking of the Royal Marsden instead. Anyway, in just a moment, we will be taken by director of the Foundling Hospital Museum, Caro Howell, and she will be giving us a personal guided tour to the goings-on down in the basement here. I keep wanting to call it a dungeon, but I really mustn't. Before that, the sponsor of our show this week is doingsomething.co.uk, and if the excitement of a Dickens day isn't enough for you, there's other things that you can find to do in London as well. Of course, you could suggest via doingsomething.co.uk that a bunch of you might want to go and see the goings on there and catch Chris's show. If you want to do that, go to doingsomething.co.uk/Londonist. Stick your details on the site and tie up with other people. Maybe get a date or just a platonic meeting of minds somewhere in this great city. So that's doingsomething.co.uk/Londonist. Later on, we'll be subjecting my two guests, Peter and Chris, to a historical quiz. But first of all, let's drift downstairs and meet director Caro Howell.
Hello.
Hello, Cara. We are here in the dungeon at the Foundling Museum. I don't think it's officially called the dungeon. We are surrounded by Dickensianalia and also pictures of a chap who I understand played a significant role in the development of the Foundling Hospital Foundling Museum and also had a direct connection with Charles Dickens.
Yes, John Brownlow was the secretary of the Foundling Hospital in the 19th century, and what makes him remarkable was that he was himself a foundling. So he grew up as a foundling and then stayed at the hospital and worked his way up the ranks and ended up as secretary. And as secretary, one of his responsibilities was collecting the pew rents, because the chapel, which was at the heart of the Foundling Hospital, one of the ways that the hospital generated funds funds was that people could rent a pew, and the hospital chapel was a very popular place to go to Sunday service. It had very good preachers, obviously a history established by Handel of wonderful music. The Foundlings themselves were a great choir, and Charles Dickens was somebody who rented a pew when he was living a couple of streets away in Doughty Street.
So this is like sponsoring a theatre seat or something along those lines?
Exactly like sponsoring a theatre seat, yes.
Could you take us around? I know there's an awful lot going on here. Could you show us some of the highlights of this exhibition?
Of course. What the exhibition is doing is really articulating the relationship between Dickens and the Foundling Hospital, which was on a number of levels. So on a very, what you might call, factual level, he supported the hospital directly by giving funds from sponsoring a pew. And one of the exhibits, you can see the chart that lays out the different seats and who was supporting the different seats. And Dickens is very clearly shown as sitting directly behind John Brownlow, so in a position of quite kind of sort of prominence. But Dickens also supported the Foundling Hospital through his own writing. So he, in Household Words, which was a serialised, what you might call a kind of journalistic magazine, he wrote a piece called Received a Blank Child, the blank being the gap that's left in the admission slip for children. So obviously the word male or female would be inserted. And he writes about the Foundling Hospital and paints it in a very good light and tells his readers what the children are learning, that they're looking happy and healthy and fit and are cared for. Then in his own fictional writing, most particularly Little Dorrit and the character Tatty Coram, who is a foundling, and Oliver Twist as well, which he wrote when he was living in Doughty Street, just around the corner. And then right at the end of his life, he wrote with Wilkie Collins a story which was then became a play called No Thoroughfare, which is again involves the Foundling Hospital and confused identity. But what's very exciting for us was that an academic in a research she was doing into the mothers and the petitioning process in the 19th century, not so long ago, she discovered completely by accident in the Foundling Hospital archive records a handwritten letter from Charles Dickens petitioning on behalf of a woman, Susan Mayne, who was trying to get her baby accepted at the hospital. And that letter is on display in the exhibition, and it's the first time it's ever been seen in public.
And do we have that on view here now?
We do, yes. It's just around the corner. Dickens himself was an amazing social campaigner. How he had time for everything he did, I have no idea. But he helped establish something that was called Urania Cottage, which was a home for what was called fallen women. And what made it unusual was that he didn't want it. Angela Burdett Coutts, who was the woman who funded it, who Coutts as in Coutts Bank, who was an extraordinarily wealthy woman, she and Charles Dickens established Urania Cottage to be somewhere that wasn't institutional. It wasn't about these fallen women being made to feel sort of guilty and sinful and be punished. It was supposed to be a homely environment in which they could, in a sense, improve themselves. And then a lot of them went to the colonies, to America, to Australia, to have a completely clean slate, start again, hopefully marry, settle down. Susan Mayne was one of the women in Urania Cottage, and she became pregnant. So it was this baby that Dickens was keen to try and get accepted into the Foundling Hospital. What's interesting is that a man of Dickens's stature was unable to, in a sense, sway things in Susan Mayne's favour, because one of the criteria for the Foundling Hospital governors, and it was a very critical criteria, was that women, in order to have their babies accepted, it had to be their first and only child, and the woman had to have been of previous good character. And Susan Mayne was discovered to have a sexually transmitted disease. And so the governors clearly took the view that she was not of previous good character, and so didn't accept her child.
It's probably a very naive question, but could we get a definition of a fallen woman?
I think it's quite tenuous. I mean, I think, as in a lot of these things, perhaps the woman had found herself in a sexual situation that was not deemed respectable by society. But I think that was quite a sliding scale. And I think then, as now, as always, women could find themselves sexually compromised by men who had promised to marry them, who they believed they were engaged with. There was sexual abuse, and then there was prostitution. So I think Certainly in the 19th century, society was very hard on women who found themselves in a particularly pregnant, but also obviously sexually active and unmarried.
I think I've been learning in recent weeks that there was a slim chance that somebody in that sort of sexually compromised position could just as easily end up in the mental asylum.
Yes, I mean, in a sense, I think, I mean, as we know, I mean, really, right into the 20th century, quite late into the 20th century, women could be incarcerated for very tenuous reasons, and yes, sort of what society deemed sexual deviance could be one.
What other positive effects has Dickens exerted on the museum and the hospital as well?
I think raising profile was absolutely critical to the hospital then, and as it had always been. I think Dickens was also able to make what was a very private, closed world, make it public for people and enable them to empathise and make connections with the foundlings and the situations they found themselves in. Dickens himself had a very traumatic childhood. He was taken out of school by his parents and sent to work in a blacking factory, which was a boot polish factory. And he found this deeply traumatising, incredibly shameful, never spoke of it to anyone other than his best friend, who, after Dickens's death, wrote the authorised biography. And I think that childhood trauma was a creative well that Dickens drew on in all his writing. So I think Dickens himself had a kind of a strong empathy with these foundlings.
Yeah, it's fascinating about the Foundling Hospital chapel, because when Dickens' sister-in-law died, he was absolutely mortified. It was the most grieving situation of his whole life. And it's said that he spent a great deal of time in the chapel, communing with God, and that was very, very helpful in the process of him healing.
Why did that particular bereavement mean so very much to him?
It is probable that he was partially in love with her. There was nothing untoward about it. When she died, she was only 17, but he did have this massive affection for her, as well as for his wife. Also on the financial side, the excellent curator of the museum didn't mention the fact that while he was in the bootblacking factory, he also had the trauma of knowing that his father was in hospital was in prison for indebtedness, and that had the most profound influence on his development as a person. He became obsessive about the need for the correct amount of money to live decently. So I think that was part of his interest in the Foundlings Hospital, the fact that people needed enough money to be able to survive. Okay, they went off the tracks, but that was largely because of finance and circumstances rather than the desire to just have sex with anybody, etc. So I think this was one of the guiding influences of his interest in these children and what would happen to them.
So keenness to get away from the sort of experiences that had marred his childhood.
That's right.
Peter, what are you making of what you're seeing here?
I'm just staggered by the amount of writing he actually did. It seems he just, every day, he seems to have got up, put his head in a bucket of cold water, and then sat down and wrote for hours on end. I don't really understand. I couldn't manage that myself. But he seems to have, as the curator said, he had huge amounts of energy. He just, as well as his many children, he just seems to be writing non-stop.
Oh, he had lots of children of his own as well.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember how many.
How many children has Dickens got?
He had 10. One of
10?
Died very young.
Good grief.
Indeed.
And all by the... Was he married just the once?
Oh, yes.
Just, well, he seems to go for multiples of everything. Word, children, I've seen them up, 20 wives or something.
She's a very busy wife, it seems, isn't it?
Well, yes. Yes, that raises a lot of time management questions as well, really, doesn't it?
It is true that the marriage ended in failure, but it also has to be said that for a very, very long time, they were deeply, intensely in love with each other, and the love letters from him to her are still to be read at the British Museum.
Really? What? When you say failure, what was the outcome of the marriage?
He was desperately unkind to his wife. He did rather blame her for having the 10 children. Well, you know, as a man of the world, I know that the man has really quite a lot to do with it, doesn't he? He also felt that they were very expensive to keep, and they perhaps didn't come up to his own, can I use the pun, great expectations. He was so extra brilliant, there's no doubt about that. We know he was his IQ was incredibly high. I think, wrongly, maybe his children were really quite disappointing to him. He still had close relationship with several of them, and like his daughters, were very close to him towards the end of his life.
We're towered over by a bust of the Reverend J.W. Gledel, and this is the preacher that Carrie mentioned packing out the Foundling Hospital chapel. And I think the most noticeable thing about the Reverend is that he looks nothing like my conception of a Victorian preacher.
No, he looks a bit more like Aristotle giving a philosophical lecture to his students, but I'm sure he's much more exciting than that.
Terrifically heroic. Not wearing traditional pastor's garb either, I've got to say. That might contribute to his Grecian appearance. He's wearing a sort of a toga-y thing. He's a very dramatic figure. Oh, wow, okay, this is a mid-Victorian, early Victorian. No, hold on. No, when did Victoria get on the throne? It was about 40, wasn't it? What? 37, okay. So this is John Brownlow's scrapbook that we're looking at here, somewhere between 1817 and 1841. So was that the... Oh, was that the Sailor King? Someone like that who was on? Have we got our dates? I want to say just after the... just after the Regency...
Victoria's 1837, but
probably.
Oh dear. I've just learnt that all of our knowledge began in 1837.
Well, quite a lot of things did actually started in 1837, because that's when they started bringing in birth certificates and death certificates, so that's the earliest time you can... So for people doing ancestral research, so it's very useful from that year on to look for finding out when people were born and died, so it's when the sort of state started really keeping tabs on people.
Do we know what prompted them to start doing that?
I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
And so here we have the scrapbook of John Brownlow, and it says in the information here that his daughters were clearly involved in adding to it in later years. It's filled with articles, poems, sketches, graphics, newspaper cuttings and theatre playbills. And just on the pages that are open to display here, we've got some sketches of faces and something that looks vaguely like an attempt at a sock puppet or a polar bear or something. I'm not really clear what that is. There's some illustrations of what look to be either very well-equipped burglars or some sort of fire team dealing with something. Goodness me, that really does show us how long ago this was. This is sort of pre-punch dandies and people wearing wigs making comic comments to each other in what looks not unlike Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens, the subject of our last visit here. There's a list of public speeches going on in Harrow in 1823, all in Latin.
I think that bringing things to life and making connections between past and present, we've tried to include that in our Dickens celebrations here at the museum. So in addition to the exhibition, we've asked a number of prominent individuals who have a relationship to either Dickens and or child welfare to select something from the Charles Dickens Museum, which is round the corner in Doughty Street, and place it in the Foundling Museum in relationship with displays we have here. So the actress Gillian Anderson has made a selection, the writer and comedian Amanda Iannucci has made a selection, John Snow, the journalist, Channel 4 news presenter, and also somebody who's very active with the children's charity New Horizons, he's made a selection. Mark Dickens, who's the head of the Dickens clan, he is a selection, and then finally Tulip Sadiq, who is the Camden Councillor for Culture, and who wrote her dissertation on Dickens and writes beautifully about developing her view of London from Dickens, which she read as a child in Dhaka as she was growing up. So I think that idea that even now Dickens is a route in for people to make that connection between the hospital, the foundlings, and that wider social situation of women and children falling through the cracks.
It's quite clear that he was a force for good in all the ways described. His contribution to literature can't be overestimated. We know that there was some questionable sides to his private life, but I sort of want to ask whether there's anything about his public work, his philanthropy. Is it all? Is there any texturing to that, or is he just a knight in shining armour?
I think the texture is this extraordinary sort of difference between his public and his private life, because there's no doubt about it, his energies in terms of his philanthropic work was enormous, from supporting the wives and children of actors and friends who had died early, his support of women like Susan Main, his petitioning on behalf of sort of the disadvantaged, his work with Urania Cottage, his work kind of for newspaper vendors is another charity that he supported. It's completely phenomenal. And he was writing all of his novels and his serialized publications like Household Words. I mean, I think his output is staggering. But it is strange then when you look at his family life and the way that he treated his wife and his quite distant relationship with his own children. And I think it makes him the more interesting and the more complex. And I don't think he's not the first person, man or woman, to have there to be a difference between the public and the private person. But I think the public person was a huge force for good. And I think somebody who was very humane, who saw things as being grey more than they were black and white in terms of notions of sin and guilt, which are terms that were very often bandied about when it came to women who found themselves in difficult personal situations.
The wonderful Caro Howell there. Thank you to Caro and to Gemma Colgan as well here at the museum for allowing us access to the exhibition. Well, Chris West and Peter Stubley, what did you make of what you saw downstairs?
I thought it was excellent. It really was. It's brought the whole subject perfectly into focus. Very, very impressed. You must come and see it, please. Everybody, come and see it.
There's something there about Dickens' women in his personal life, which we sort of touched on there. Seems like a rather dark underbelly. And, of course, after the guided tour from Caro, she did mention as well Tolstoy, who she considers to be a far superior writer when it comes to depicting women, and yet far more of an expletive when it comes to his treatment of women. I wonder what that's about, that sort of duality.
For some reason, a lot of famous writers and celebrities seem to be not exactly liberal when it comes to treating women for some reason. I'm not sure why that is. Recently, the Justin Lee Collins, although it's hard to call him a celebrity. It's more, he has a chat show, I suppose. But he was recently in news convicted of harassing his former girlfriend. So
yes, that's right. Apparently she had to write down all of her previous sexual encounters for him and had to sleep in a particular way. And He threw out, apparently, all of the DVDs that contained film stars that she took a shine to. I don't know if we can really generalise from any of those ideas. I know, Peter, that you've had generalisations made about you simply because the subject you choose to write about is on the gruesome end of the spectrum.
Yeah, just because I mean, my day job is a court reporter at the Old Bailey, so I basically sit in listening to murder trials all the time. So I think the first question that a lot of people ask me is, Aren't you affected by that? Are you a weirdo? And then finally, are you a serial killer?
Where the hell is the logic in that line of questioning? Okay, so let's take this. I'm going to dismiss the are you a weirdo. I mean, rightly or wrongly, I've no idea. But are you a serial killer? Seems like a very strange thing. You're a serial killer, so you go and start reporting on court cases. That doesn't fly. But what about the idea that you take a rather gruesome delight in some of this stuff? Is there anything in that?
To be honest, I don't read a lot of thriller books or murder mystery books. I think I just like the stories that come out and it's interesting psychology of what puts people in these situations where they've, you know, one minute you're married to somebody and the next minute you've battered them to death with a rolling pin. It's working out what's going on in somebody's mind at that time. I find it a bit fascinating sometimes. So.
Are you shockable?
Yes. I mean, I think it's easy to, when it's not happening to you and when you're just listening to it, it's easy to sort of detach yourself from it slightly. I mean, obviously, if somebody came out with me with a knife, I'd be very shocked.
I'm curious to know what you think about some of the ideas being posited by the Tory conference at the moment. You'll bear in mind, and I think there's a lot of political point scoring rather than it necessarily being a serious policy suggestion, but it seems that they've suggested that householders are able to take action up to grossly disproportionate action against, for example, burglars or home invaders, which seems to me a better term, from stateside. And I think Chris Grayling explained that the what would be inappropriate was if you knocked a burglar out in your home and he's lying there unconscious and then you stab him. That's not okay, but anything up until that point is. Seems to me like sort of policing on the cheap or something like that, just arming the household, a bit of a domestic militia or something like that. What do you think of that kind of idea as policy, given the sort of stuff that you see every day in your court reporting job?
Well, it's quite rare, to be honest. Usually it's the householder who gets the worst end of it. And I think these situations where householder actually kills or injures a burglar is few and far between. But I mean, it seems to me that the jury's in the best position to work that out. I mean, the police are still going to have to investigate these incidents anyway, so it's hard to see how the government can actually say, well, this is something you can go investigate and this isn't. I mean, so it seems a bit overly prescriptive, because every situation is different. I mean, there's been some cases where somebody's shot at a burglar who's running away. I mean, fair enough, they came into your house with a knife, but he's running away. Does that still give you the right to shoot him in the back? I'm not sure.
It seems to me that a lot of the stuff we're talking about here has the sense, I don't know if this is strictly true even as I start the sentence, but the idea of foundlings, of servants having to conceal births, things of those sort, that they seem to be things that are long past. And as I say, I could be completely wrong about that, but they don't seem like current issues. As you compare the murders of 1888 to the sort of murders, and of course the Old Bailey does deal with some spectacularly serious stuff, what similarities do you see?
Funny enough, there's quite a lot of similarities between then and now in society anyway, because at the time there was an old Etonian prime minister. The Queen was celebrating a jubilee at the time. I think police commissioners resigning. I think the Commissioner for London recently, well, I think it was a couple of years ago now, various scandals happening. And the only thing we're missing is a rampaging serial killer, thankfully. So, there still exists, domestic murders. They're still happening, even though they're overlooked by the newspapers nowadays. I think the major difference is the infanticides, which you see very rarely now. I mean, I think there was a case recently of a newborn baby found in a field in a bin somewhere in South London, but it's very rare now, whereas at that time there was literally dozens of happening in a year. So
it is remarkable, isn't it, that the domestic murders get such a low profile. If my memory serves, 2 women per week are killed in domestic murders, and I certainly don't see them paraded across the front of the newspaper, all of which is miserable territory. So let's lighten the mood a little bit and talk about some positive upcoming stuff. Let's talk about Simon Callow. He's a figure much associated with Dickens. I know, I sort of see a gleam of admiration in your eye, Chris West.
I have to say that from 4 weddings and a funeral, that's the first time I can remember sort of watching him, as it were. And he's now at the Playhouse in London. I think it finishes 15th of November. And he's doing a mystery, The Mystery of Charles Dickens, taken from the Peter Ackroyd script. Peter Ackroyd is certainly my favourite book about Dickens. And Simon Callow is absolutely masterful. There's no doubt about it. He stands there doing his one-man show. He has the eye contact with the entire audience, the way Dickens did.
Oh, right, so he's performing as in the style that Dickens read.
Indeed. And it's well known that Dickens wasn't the greatest of actors, but he was probably the greatest in his one-man shows. And he could raise 14, 15, 16,000 pounds by today's standards by his after-dinner speeches. He was absolutely superb at that aspect of what he did. Well, Simon Callow has studied it so deeply, and I think he's probably the nearest we'll ever see to a perfect imitation of Charles Dickens on stage. He goes through the characters one by one, completely changing it all around. It's exciting, it's vibrating right the way through the whole performance. Again, I would say do go and see it. If he's not too worn out, he's then going from this one-man show to Christmas Carol, and he'll be doing that from the day after my event. I think it's the 26th of November.
You've been known to don a beard yourself, of course.
Oh, yes, I dress up as Charles Dickens for my talks, but I'm not in his league. I'm really not. I'm a lot cheaper, but, but I'm not in his league. He's an absolute maestro. I can't speak highly enough of my thrill at seeing him in that.
I wish you wouldn't sit on the fence like this. It's very difficult to know what you feel about the whole thing. Chris, I understand that you want to gather together Paralympians.
Yes, Paralympians, Olympians for this great event that we're holding on the 25th November, and also anybody else who is really inspirational in terms of doing half-hour talks to these youngsters who will be coming through and having a really big thrill. We want them to go home having had a fantastic time, a great celebration of Dickens, and be very proud of raising money for such a wonderful hospital, Great Ormond Street.
And as you say, particularly keen to hear from people who, well, you mentioned a Paralympian who has connection with Great Ormond Street. He was himself, had to go through the Great Ormond Street Institution and was healed by them and went on to win, I think, 2 medals at the Paralympics. Him or anybody like him who is able to reflect on what Great Ormond Street is all about, how it's helped them perhaps, and really the idea that you can come through troubled times and a difficult medical history and still triumph. How can people get in touch with you if they'd like to participate or want to suggest someone?
Anybody who of an inspirational nature, as we've described, can just get in touch with me. I can give my phone number.
Let's give an email address or something like that.
Yes. My email is chriswandco@yahoo.co.uk, or my website is www.charlesdickenslondon.net.
Since we're in website territory, it seems churlish not to find out where we can purchase a copy of the... Well, what's the full title of the book?
It's 1888, London Murders in the Year of the Ripper.
Really trading on the Ripper stuff. Yeah. We have to be honest here. Not quite avoiding Ripperism at all.
Yeah, it's hard to avoid it, really, because the reason behind it was because of Jack the Ripper anyway. So plus, obviously, the History Press who publish it, it helps sell it, I think, is the answer.
Do you do a sort of website or a blog or anything like that from inside the court? I suppose that you're pretty restricted, aren't you?
Well, I don't want to talk about murders all day, but I do sort of run the Murder Map website, which aims to sort of track every murder that happens in London.
To what end?
So they're not forgotten, really, and just to, so that people can see what's happening in their area, if they want to. So there's a trend at the moment to, in you know, particularly in America, to map murders and other crimes, and it's sort of the idea is so that people know what's happening in their local area.
I'm astonished to hear that you're doing it rather than a government department.
The government obviously have their own website, but it doesn't actually focus on murders. So it's, and I think we started before them, but. Yeah, it's...
So you're sort of single-handedly responsible for the house prices fluctuations in...
we have had people sending emails saying, oh, please don't mention the house number because I'd quite like to rent my house out, please. And we've had other emails saying, oh, I was shocked to discover that a murder happened in the same room I'm living in. We're obviously not going out there trying to depress housing market, although that would be nice as it's quite expensive to live here as it is anyway.
But. Ah, I see your strategy now. Right, so you're looking to get on the housing ladder and you thought, I know. Chris West and Peter Stubley, we have just time to fit in the weekly torture that is the historical quiz. I've got 5 questions for you. It's a head-to-head thing. And Chris, how did you get on the last time, Chris?
Absolute rubbish, like the Prime Minister, so I'm in good company.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, he's not doing very well on historical stuff. Okay, well, let's see if we can do better this time. Here we go. Monday, the 8th of October, 1965. The Post Office Tower, now known, of course, as the BT Tower, in Fitzrovia, becomes operational as a major hub for national microwave communications. Little known fact, today it is apparently the only building in the UK that is legally allowed to do what?
Broadcast?
Not broadcast.
Have parties all night? I don't know.
No, but
I can't say.
Harold Wilson opened it.
Good fact, not the fact we're looking for. Okay, think about emergencies and the shape of it. It's the only building legally allowed to do what? Fires.
Blast off into space.
Blast off into space, yes, is the correct... No, it's not the correct... It is the only building legally allowed to be evacuated using its lifts. Well, there you go. There's the thing. Next time you go to a party, all night or otherwise.
Yes.
So no points so far. Tuesday, the 9th of October, 1975, an IRA bomb explodes at a bus stop near which tube station, killing one person and injuring many others. 1975.
I saw this in the somewhere.
What did you see?
Aldgate?
Not Aldgate. You need to go further west.
Earl's Court?
Nope.
Tottenham Court Road?
You're sort of beginning to circle it now.
Marble Arch? Green Park?
Green Park, yes, there we go. That was torturous. A vaguely deserved point there for Peter Stubley. Wednesday, the 10th of October, 1881. Okay, you've got no excuses, either of you. The Savoy Theatre is opened on the Strand, becoming the first public building in the world to benefit from what modern feature?
Electric light.
Yes, Home and Dry, Chris West. Electric light. First building in the world to be entirely lit by electricity. There's a bonus point here if you want it. Gilbert and Sullivan put a production on as the first performance to be hosted at the new theatre. Do you want to have a shot at what it was? Little known one.
I was going to say Madame Butterfly. It's not...
No, they're not little known enough, no.
Patience.
It was Patience, yes. Well done, Chris, too. Fantastic. So you're in the lead now. You've got one point ahead of Peter Stubley. Thursday, 11th of October, 1573. Sir John Hawkins, Treasurer of the Royal Navy, suffers an assassination attempt while riding down the Strand. The would-be assassin, one Peter Burchett, stabbed Hawkins, mistaking him for Sir Christopher Hatton. I hope you're following this. Despite being severely injured by the attack, Hawkins would survive. But what became of the attacker, Burchett?
I assume he was convicted, sentenced, and cruelly butchered on the hung, drawn, and quartered.
He was hanged, yes, that'll do it. Yes, no surprises there, really. So we've got two all. It all hangs on the last question. Good luck, fellas. Friday, the 12th of October, 1609. London composer Thomas Ravencroft publishes an early version of what would become a very well-known nursery rhyme. But which one?
Oranges and lemons?
Nope.
Bar, bar, black sheep?
Nope.
London Bridge is falling down?
Was it falling down by that point? No, not that one.
16. Three blind mice.
Three blind mice, yes, well done.
Come on,
our first ever musical accompaniment to a... Chris West, I'm delighted to say that you've pulled yourself back from the jaws of defeat. he's taking about Peter Stubley an admirable second place. Very good. We have to tie off. We're right up against the clock. A quick reminder of where people can find your book about the other murders of 1888, Peter Stubley.
If you just type into Google, it will come up there in all its non-glory.
And Chris West, details perhaps of your Great Ormond Street gig.
Yes, sponsors, volunteers, whatever. Chris W. and Co. at yahoo.co.uk.
Thank you for joining us here. And once again, thank you to the Foundling Museum for having us. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to my guests, Peter Stubley and Chris West. Also to Caro Howell and Gemma Colgan. Thanks too to Bernie Barkley, Zoe Craig and Dave Haste. Theme and incidental music was by Jack Hurd and Rory Anderson. And I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. Lying, waiting for the river's care. Straining for the blooming waves calling from the shore. Singing in the sunlight, break the heart.
palace of the open sea. Faith turned sour, bitter with the rolling year. And you can smother my shouts, smother the cries, but these bones will like us to singing in the sunlight. Break the heart.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.